This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
I'm Cressy Twigg from the Global Jigsaw podcast from the BBC World Service, where we are asking, what would the potential loss of military bases in Syria mean for Russia? The naval and air bases have been a springboard for Moscow's foreign missions aimed at growing its geopolitical footprint in Africa. The Global Jigsaw looks at the world through the lens of its media. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Liberia's parliament caught fire earlier in the week amid protests and a tug of war between the government and the opposition parties. What's going on?
The head of the fire service spoke on the media yesterday and told them that there's a possibility of foul play, but also politically there are concerns that some senators are saying that they need $1.8 million to fix this building. So the sudden mention of money is also raising concern that this may be politically motivated.
And if you are Nigerian, you'd be familiar with the term Dirty December. The rest of us can't wait to find out. It's Friday, December 20th. First, we go to Somalia. On Africa's longest coastline, piracy is resurging. At its peak, Somali pirates cost the global economy an estimated $7 billion, with hundreds of millions in ransom payments. While international patrols in the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean had nearly eliminated piracy, strained resources caused by Houthi rebel activity in Yemen and grievances over illegal fishing have led to a renewed wave, particularly in the northeastern region. Sahnun Mohamed, a BBC Somali correspondent, travelled to El Town, the centre of piracy in Somalia.
This resurgence of Somali pirates is considerable. For the past months, they hijacked several vessels. Some of them were commodity ships, and others were fishing boats from some Asian countries, such as Yemen and Iran. As we speak in Charles, a fishing vessel from China is in the hands of the Somali pirates. And according to the media reports, they are demanding millions of dollars. We can feel that it's not similar to that previous peak, but it can be the start of a wider trend that can come in the future.
Sahnun managed to meet pirates face to face and engage them in a conversation. Here is what they had to say.
When you take guns and go to sea, you don't know the kind of ships you will encounter. You can feel that it's not right. But it is a result of your belongings being taken repeatedly. When we go and ask for our belongings back, they shoot at us and treat us badly. That is what forced us.
Wallahi, you can see that it's a bad thing to do. But as my friend says, there's a cause. From where we are now, some men set out with nets to fish. They went to sea. After 3 days, we found their bodies. There were bullets in their bodies. Your brother or cousin takes nets and goes to the sea to try to make a living. He had no weapons, but then he comes back dead, with bullets in his body.
But how did Sahnun get the pirates to open up? Let's listen.
It's a long process, and it took me at least 2 months to convince them to talk to us. Obviously, it's a bit, you know, complicated and tricky to talk to those guys, you know, directly.
Yeah.
But there is always some middle people that can connect you with the pirates. So they have sort of policies. For instance, if you are a journalist working with international media, they have that fear of that you can harm, you know, them. And the most trick thing was me to, you know, convince them to believe me that I'm just a journalist and my agenda is to just do reporting.
And so when you spoke to them, what's the main thing you wanted to find out from them and what did they say about that?
For a while, piracy activities was not possible in Somali waters. And this was something that I asked initially, how are they managing to go to the sea and hijack ships again? We knew like there were a lot of forces on the sea and also on the ground. So I wanted to know, how is this possible and what is, you know, motivating this new generation of pirates? They told us the same excuse that the previous pirates used to tell to the media, mm-hmm. which is they used to be fishermen and they have problem with these trawlers that are stealing their nets, their equipment.
So they feel because of the illegal fishing, then they are left without a way or a means to earn some income. And therefore they find themselves getting into piracy.
Yes.
Is anything being done to stop this new wave?
There are local maritime police force under the authority of Puntland State of Somalia. They have limited resources. For instance, their boats are very small. They have small guns, but they conduct regular operations and they try to arrest pirates. There are also an EU European Union operation called Atlanta, which is just outside Somali waters. And they told us that they help local forces to prevent piracy. But there are two other factors that are still making harder to prevent piracy activities in Somali waters. One is the Houthi rebels in Yemen who have been attacking ships since November 2023. And those activities, they somehow distracted the naval attention, the European Union naval attention. And the other factor is there was a UN resolution which allowed international forces to enter Somali waters, but it expired recently. So locally and internationally, you can feel that they are trying to prevent piracy, but they still cannot make it.
So what's been the effect of these activities then, of the pirates, on Puntland and its people?
Well, I was in Puntland, especially Garowe, the capital city of Puntland. I met with several business people and visited different shops. They told me that there is significant delays of goods coming from abroad to Somalia. And that is having direct impact to the localists who want to buy food and other groceries from those shops. So it is direct impact on the localists.
Let's talk about illegal fishing a bit more, because, you know, it's a reason these pirates gave you as to why they are getting into piracy. How widespread is this issue of illegal fishing in the waters of Somalia? And is anything being done to confront that by the authorities?
I met several fishermen in Isle Town of Somalia. Most of them, they were talking about cases that they were either targeted by armed illegal fishing boats or their equipment was stolen when they left it at sea. Although the pirates' claims is not, independently verified, but they claimed that they, you know, also used to be fishermen. And the reason that motivated them to take guns and go to the sea is those trawlers. And everywhere in the town, the coastal area, when you meet someone like a fisherman, they would tell you that trawlers are making their life hard. And they are saying they are stealing their livelihoods. Isle Town, the people in Isle Town, all their life relies on the sea. Most of them are fishermen. They do not have other source of incomes. So it will give you that sense that trawling fishing boats is impacting their lives directly.
So tell me this, Salnoun, do you think we are looking at a situation that's likely to escalate further and probably even reach the peak where we would be reporting about billions of dollars in the global economy being lost due to the piracy activities off the coast of Somalia?
When you ask this question, the experts, they will tell you that Somali pirates do not have that chance again to reach their peak. But looking into the reality on the ground and what the localists tell you, and also the pirates that we met in Isle, Somalia, I think as long as the people in Puntland who rely on the sea for their livelihood feel they do not have other economic opportunities, piracy will still continue.
BBC Somali's Sahnoun Mohamed. The parliament building in Liberia caught fire Wednesday, with the country's president, Joseph Boakai, condemning what he called wanton destruction. The flames destroyed the entire joint chambers of the legislature, but no one was in the building at the time. Authorities did not immediately confirm the cause of the fire in the city, but police did not rule out arson. The thing is that it comes as the country is in the middle of a long political crisis. There were protests in the country on Tuesday over the decision to remove the parliament speaker, an opposition figure who faces accusations of corruption, allegations he denies. The demonstrators also call for President Boakai to step down. So far, no link has been made between the fire and the anti-government protests. I caught up with Rondin Sie, editor of Liberia's Front Page Africa newspaper.
This is still sketchy for many Liberians to understand. Just a day earlier, there had been protest in the country that was foiled by the government in terms of police using tear gas to unravel protesters. There was some arrest, and people don't understand why their protest was not allowed to take place. At the back of this fire is the fact that the national budget has not been passed in weeks and months. The legislative battle is being fought on both sides in terms of the embattled speaker for Nari Kofa. He doesn't have the quorum to preside. And the other side, the so-called majority bloc, do not have the exact numbers to really carry out their duty. So it's a matter of the uncertainty left in terms of whether the speaker should step aside. So there is this level of uncertainty, a level of issues that people are not sure what's going on. So it seems like we're still not sure where this thing is going.
So briefly, just explain to us the two sides here in terms of who is in government, who is in opposition in terms of parties.
The embattled speaker, Jefferson Nati Kofa, heads the minority bloc. He has about 36, 37 lawmakers on his side. And the elected speaker was elected from among the other group. They're about maybe between 39 and 41. So they're all just on both sides. But the constitution said there has to be a two-third majority vote to remove the speaker. They don't have that. The majority bloc headed by Richard Cohn, he's from the president's ruling party, and so he's been elected by his peers. The group headed by this embattled speaker for Nari Kofa is saying that in order for the speaker to preside fully, he must be voted by all members of the House, not just one side. So I think that's where the bulk of the problem is coming from. Until either side has a majority, there's always going to be some kind of confusion.
It's basically a case where there's a speaker that was representing the minority in parliament, and the ruling party, are they trying to force their way into electing a new speaker? Is that what has happened in the last few weeks?
That's the bulk of the problem. And surprisingly, the embattled speaker, Jefferson Nari Kofa, was a surprising ally to the president. And initially, he was siding with the president on other issues. So people are still baffled as to why the president is using the whole year of his campaign on trying to remove the speaker that was elected by his peers in terms of how, you know, this thing is playing out.
So let me ask in very few words, why is this speaker being removed, this Mr. Jonathan Fonati Kofa? Why is he getting removed?
Well, this is an age-old Liberian problem. Although people die in the civil war and people fought for justice and human rights, there's this belief by governments past and present that they must control all branches of government. I think the desire to have control of the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judiciary is something that this government is trying to do, like its predecessor. When the last government was in power, President George Weah had control of the executive branch. His party was in control of the House and the Senate. So I think this government is also trying to do the same thing. And I think that's the desire, they're pushing for that. In the process, the government is handicapped because a lot of things are happening that is taken away from the objective of trying to provide the basic commodities and the bread and butter issues of Liberian people.
How are all these political events connected to the fire? Is there any connection at all?
Well, it's still too early to say. Although the head of the fire service spoke on the media yesterday and told them that there's a possibility of foul play, The police chief seemed to think that there's also a possibility of foul play. But also politically, there are concerns that some senators are saying that they need $1.8 million to fix this building, and it should come from taxpayers' money. So the sudden mention of money a day after a fire is also raising concern that this may be politically motivated. Also, the issue of the police who were in charge of the guarding of this building were on site when this thing happened. There's also a possibility that there could have been an electrical fault, because 2 weeks ago there was a fire incident at the same building. There's a construction going on right now in that part of the building that was halted by the majority block a few days ago. So there's a lot of concerns about whether this is actually an ordinary electrical problem, a political mess that they put themselves in, or some issue that's still relating to what's going on in all stages of things in the country.
But also there's been protests going on this week. Who is protesting and why?
All the protests have been organized by remnants of former President George Weah's government and also supporters of the speaker, and the fiery lawmaker Yeke Koluba and others were part of the planners of this protest. The aim was to send a message to the government that they're not happy with the way things are playing out. As you know, during the former President George Weah, a similar protest was held on June 7th that kind of raised awareness about uncertainties in the country. I think the police, the way they handled it, have been criticized, but also I think they were afraid of having a massive protest heavy weight on the government and the way it's handling the country. At the same time, there's lots of calls from international stakeholders for the observance of the rule of law and governance, the pillars of democracy that's been pushed around. I think those are things that people are looking at closely to see how not just the executive branch, but the legislative branch will handle the situation in terms of bringing this matter to a close.
In closing then, Rodney, the president, Joseph Boakai, came in power not long ago, just at the beginning of the year. What's being overlooked here in terms of the actual needs in the country, the things that people would have hoped get fixed either through parliament or through the executive? What's the opportunity cost of all of these things that are happening?
Well, that's the sad picture for Liberia, as it was and is in other African countries. Politicians make runs at presidency in hopes of inspiring a nation and doing things that will help resuscitate a country. But once elected, people come in and they change their minds. So I think the Boakai administration is having that same problem. And it's bringing back memories of previous governments in terms of how an administration handles the bread and butter issues. The fact that the budget is still hanging in the air, it hasn't passed. And so it's a lot of underlying factors that needs to be fixed. And usually the first 90 days is looked at the time for government to put their foot down. And now we're going through a year now, almost a year in this government, and we're still seeing the budget hasn't passed, which is not a good sign. The next few weeks and months, as the new year approaches, will be key to how the Boakai administration hopes to deal with these bread and butter issues, which are at the core of the existence and survival of Liberian economy.
Right, Rodney, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much, Charles. Appreciate it.
Rodney Sie in Monrovia. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
I'm Krassi Twigg from the Global Jigsaw podcast from the BBC World Service, where we are asking, what would the potential loss of military bases in Syria mean for Russia? The naval and air bases have been a springboard for Moscow's foreign missions aimed at growing its geopolitical footprint in Africa. The Global Jigsaw looks at the world through the lens of its media. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Lagos is buzzing, as usual, with its annual Dirty December festivities.
I don't want a lot for Christmas.
The term Dirty December was popularized by Nigerian musician Mr. Easy in 2016. It encapsulates the city's festive spirit during the holiday season. But locals are not necessarily impressed by those returning to the country to join in the festive celebrations. They say the return of their fellow Nigerians results in the rise of prices, for example, and adds to the perennial Lagos traffic. This year, international celebrities have added to the buzz, sparking debates on Lagos's global appeal versus its struggles to present itself as a true tourist destination. So I set out to explore the complex relationship between the residents of Lagos and diaspora returnees keen to reconnect with family and friends during this season. I've been speaking to Sunny Mistura Morenikeji, a law graduate and feminist influencer who lives and works in Lagos, and Tauhid Bayo, who has just returned to Lagos for the festivities. He is what Nigerians call IJGB. So I started by asking him what that means.
It means I just got back, a terminology that was coined over the last few years to describe typically Nigerians, because you know the word just got back would infer that you had left at some point. So basically implying that you just got back from, you know, anywhere in the diaspora, from Europe to America to, yeah, wherever in the world you just got back from.
And for this year, did you just get back or not yet?
I quite literally just got back less than 12 hours ago. So right as described. Yes.
For you then, what's the most striking part of your experience returning to Lagos?
I think it's the level of rootedness and groundedness that I feel quite literally from the plane rides even, right? From the plane rides, a lot of the people that are on the planes are Nigerian. So you can, from the voices, you can already feel this nostalgia from the voices, from the anger and the frustration on the planes and the delays. There's this level of like familiarity that you feel just from the body language and their voices. So there's that level of like familiarity. And then now that I'm in Lagos, on island, I feel so rooted already. And I've only been here for a few hours. Like I said, there's a level of nostalgia. This feels like home. The body is at rest. Yeah.
I'll come to you now, Mistura. It's people like Tauhid that are getting people talking in Lagos and other parts of Nigeria. Do they feel an interference when these guys come during December and the party is about to get started?
Kind of. A city that is as small yet as densely populated as Lagos will definitely feel the impact of people returning like in their numbers for like a specific month. So it's not necessarily an interference, but you kind of feel the impact in your day-to-day activities. From transportation to commute to accommodation, all those things, you will know that like there are more people in the city, like there are a lot more people in the city, and that's what was causing a lot of things.
What happens when you have a lot of people coming in?
So when there are more people in Lagos, it would interfere with things like pricing, with things like tipping, and even something as basic as like a cab ride and all.
And then the prices go up.
Yeah, the prices go up. And the very strange thing about Lagos is once prices go up, they barely ever come down. They will not come down. They just accept it as the new norm moving forward. That's kind of how it goes. That's how it interferes with like day to day.
Tauhid, what do you think of that? You people are disrupting the market.
Yes, no, I definitely share in a sentiment because I do have family that live in Lagos, and in our conversations when I'm parking and getting excited to come back, that, oh, you guys are coming back to, for the lack of a better word, disrupt the flow of things here. Like when they see me, they can hear from my accent that I'm not from here. So they're going to try to upcharge me on whatever I'm buying. It could be food, it could be a ride. And I sympathize with Nigerians or like with locals because like Mistura said, it becomes the new norm, right? Once the prices go up, it never returns back to the original. And now when we leave in about 3 to 4 weeks, these locals that are typically based here and now stuck with this unfair prices that we've kind of forced upon them just by quite literally just being here.
When we say it's dirty December, when you're coming back for that, Tauhid, what exactly are you coming for? Is it to reconnect with family or are we looking at the events, the vibe of the city?
It's like a workation, right? When you're going on a workation, it's like you're going for work but also going for a vacation. So when I think of dirty December, it kind of falls in that line for me, right? I'm coming back to, you know, do all the partying. But like I said, I also have family here. So there's a level of like weddings, birthday dinners. There's a level of gathering, intentional gathering that, you know, involves family and close friends that I'm looking forward to when I'm coming back. Of course, I'm looking forward to like your party at the popular clubs. So there's that. And, you know, luckily for me, I'm a full-time artist as well. So I'm always looking forward to my offerings. I say humble offerings because it's not too much, but my humble offerings when I'm returning home. And, you know, for me, that could take different forms. This year, I'm doing a book launch. So for me, that's an offering. When I'm returning back home, I'm like, what can I offer beyond just coming to take and drive the prices of? What can I offer the community or offer the land that I'm returning to? I try to do charity as well to the needy, to the people that don't have as much as I do.
So, Ms. Tura, are there some misconceptions then that you think, especially from outside of Lagos, outside of Nigeria, when we read about this, are there misconceptions both in the country and also outside in terms of what this is all about, Dirty December, people coming back, the whole concept of I just got back?
Yeah, I definitely think there is. And you can't experience December in Lagos and not have complaints. Like, even if you are not going out, the prices of things like fuel, the price to just move from like your house to maybe a restaurant or something, everything is going to affect you. So when you complain about these things, people usually misconstrue it to mean that you are essentially asking returnees to go back to where they are coming. And that's really not what it's about. That's not what it is at all. It's more of like a critique of the infrastructure as opposed to criticizing the people who are actually, you know, coming back to meet family, to reconnect and all of that.
Tawhid, what do you think about that? And when you come back, do you get that sort of energy where perhaps some people think you are there to change something, to change their lives, not in a very positive way?
No, I speak the native language of Yoruba. So I would say I'm one of the few lucky ones that when they return, I won't understand everything that's been said around me. When you speak someone's language, there's a level of acceptance that you, it doesn't matter if it's in Lagos or anywhere in the world.
And the prices you're about to get charged come down.
Exactly. Anywhere in the world, right? Europe, here, when you speak the language of the person that you're next to, there's a level of acceptance immediately, right? You can hear that in their tone and in the modulations of your conversations. You can tell that, okay, this person has an affinity for me because I speak the language. So for me, luckily, I do not deal with that hostility, like Ms. Tura said. And the hostility, like Ms. Tura said, is very misconstrued and very much, I wouldn't say made up, because I know people that have experienced the hostility. But for me, I think it was something that was blown out of the waters, because social media is such a, it's a world in its own.
I'm wondering why this is just a concept, Dirty December, that seems to be quite strong in Lagos. Is it the same in Abuja or other big cities and towns in Nigeria?
Now, Lagos is the most commercial city in all of Nigeria. Even people who left from places like Abuja to go abroad, when they're coming back, they usually spend maybe a weekend or a week or something in Lagos, because this is where everything happens. Recently, there have like been efforts to diversify, you know, do a couple of shows in Abuja, do a couple of shows in the East, all of that. But Lagos is essentially where everything happens. It's where the social life happens. Even if you're going to go to other states, you still feel like you are missing out if you don't get to Lagos. This is where all the artists come to, all the nightlife. Everybody is going to be in Lagos for at least for a time before they move on to wherever else they're going to.
Let's hear your tips of how you're going to navigate this Dirty December. We can start with Tawhid. You just got back. What do you plan to do? How do you plan to get around?
Yeah, navigation starts way before you land. I'm sure Ms. Tura can speak to that with her family member coming back. You have to, you know, speak to people that are going to pick you up from the airport way before you land. That way, you know, you feel secure and safe in like whatever choices or decisions you're making. So that, you know, that started with that. Communication is big, right? So for me, I'm like, okay, do I need a SIM, eSIM? Luckily now we're, you know, 2024. There's eSIMs that you could, you know, buy online before you arrive in Lagos. In Europe, the eSIMs work exceptionally well. In Lagos, sometimes I've had issues using the eSIM. So most people just advise you to go get a local SIM. I think, you know, as a traveler, the two biggest things is your mode of transportation, and secondly, your mode of communications. Dinners planned, parties that I already bought tickets to, that are planned ahead of time. But Lagos, you know, your big metropolitan cities, you can do things on the go. Things are very immediate. There's a level of urgency that people move with here that I appreciate when I come back as well. It's like, okay, now, kia, kia. You know, like things are quick and fast.
How about you, Ms. Tura? Because your experience is very, very different.
One thing is, like he said, everybody has to plan, because there are at least two events every single day from the 1st to the 31st. Different types of events. There are some that are free, some are paid. Some you can't go, it's too far. Some you will just meet traffic on the road. So you have to plan. For the locals, I don't think we do as extensive planning, because you're very much used to the pace of the city. But you still have to factor in prices. You don't buy chickens too close to Christmas period, because they will become unnecessarily expensive. You have to learn to carpool, essentially. Like, if you take Ubers on your own, if you're going out in December, more often than not, you're going to have to carpool, especially if you're going from the mainland to the island. how to carpool, how to network with other people, how to talk and all of that. Then your finances, you have to plan your finances, because we always say that, you know, December is very fleeting and January is long. January has 50 something days. Like, that's just a common sentiment. I know. So you have to plan your January. Like, you have to plan properly. And also, you don't end up in debt. Or you just have to know, okay, this is your hard limit. This is your boundary. This is what you want to do. This is what you don't want to do. And then you'll be fine.
Thanks very much to Sunny Mistra Morenikeji and Tawhid Bayo. Focus on Africa was produced by Bella Hassan and Rob Wilson in London and Toda Opeyemi in Lagos. Connie Sharp was the senior journalist in charge and Francesca Dan was the technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Muthengi. I'm Charles Bitonga. Speak again soon.
I'm Crassie Twig from the Global Jigsaw podcast from the BBC World Service, where we are asking, what would the potential loss of military bases in Syria mean for Russia? The naval and air bases have been a springboard for Moscow's foreign missions aimed at growing its geopolitical footprint in Africa. The Global Jigsaw looks at the world through the lens of its media. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.